This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Time's up, or is it? Well, the state harbor officials gave owners of the Falls of Clyde until yesterday to remove the ship from Honolulu Harbor. If you walk past Aloha Tower today, you'll see that the 280-foot-long vessel is still there. The ship's owned by a local nonprofit trying to save the Falls of Clyde from a watery grave or a scrap heap. The group purchased it from Bishop Museum in 2008 for a dollar, with the goal of restoring the ship, which at one point was going to be deliberately sunk and turned into an artificial reef. But the Falls of Clyde hasn't left its berth in decades. State regulators impounded the ship in 2016, citing a threat to the port of Honolulu. If the vessel sinks during a major storm, it could block access to the port. The Friends of the Falls of Clyde thought it had a plan to send the vessel back to its original home in Glasgow, Scotland, but a deal with the Scottish group fell apart at the last minute. The State Harbors Division gave the two groups an ultimatum: come up with a new plan by Wednesday or we auction off the ship. Bruce McEwen is the president of the locally based Friends of the Falls of Clyde.
Seven-star yacht transport is still willing to come in to make the move. They've indicated that they can do the job. They need 50% down up front, but they said the earliest it looks like they can get here is June.
That may be an issue. The state wants the ship out of the harbor before June 1st, the start of hurricane season. McEwen indicated that the Scotland-based group was waiting on a grant to fund the move.
He's indicated that he's also waiting for approval on a substantive grant from a UK company called Ocean Resource Management. They have apparently been in contact with the Harbors Division to indicate their financial resources in support of this project.
The he McEwen is referring to is David O'Neill, president of the Scotland-based Save Falls of Clyde International, who sent us this written statement overnight. Logistically, we're governed by the lift operators and contractors and their ability to transport the ship, and we all want to avoid a repeat of last week's emergency. Security and upkeep of the vessel remains a responsibility for the Friends of Falls of Clyde until we are able to take full ownership of the vessel, an action we have agreed that will not be complete until she is leaving Honolulu Harbor. It was always our agreement with Friends of Falls of Clyde that we would take control of the ship on the day of the lift operation and at that time take over all the legal harbor requirements. That's still our commitment. In conclusion, I wish to make it clear that we're still 100% committed to ensuring the safe removal of the Falls of Clyde from Honolulu to Scotland, a commitment that has never wavered. We are all reaching for the same goal. I believe that we work together, we can achieve this incredible task and be remembered in history as the people who saved this beautiful vessel. Bruce McEwen told us his organization has secured a local contractor to address any future maintenance issues. So there's a bit of finger-pointing going on with this deadline upon us. No official word from the State Department of Transportation as of this morning. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. It's no secret that Hawaii needs more affordable housing, including affordable rentals. But getting that housing built has proved difficult for local policymakers. In recent years, expensive luxury condos have been the preferred choice for developers. Urban Honolulu is full of middle-class apartment buildings, and most were built decades ago. A new initiative from Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell and Councilmember Kim Pine aims to change that. HPR's Ryan Finnerty explains how.
It's a pretty simple economic problem. When demand for something exceeds supply, the price goes up. That's the situation on Oahu, where the average price of a single-family home is more than $800,000. It's one of the chief problems confronting Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell.
Honolulu has changed dramatically, and demands have been incredible. And all of us are struggling with how do we build more true, affordable housing. Really, the big demand is in a rental housing component. There's right now a demand for 25,000 units. And if we could even build enough to get to there, there's always more demand.
To bring down the cost of housing, Mayor Caldwell has committed to building more housing, the supply side of the problem. But the city is reliant on developers to do the building, and luxury condos are more profitable than affordable rentals. Caldwell outlined the challenge in the Honolulu neighborhood of Makiki.
How do we incentivize local landowners who own lots of 20,000 feet or lower? How do we incentivize local contractors but don't have as much opportunity when you're talking about these very large citywide high-rises? And how do we incentivize local financing? You know, these giant projects that cost $300 and $400 million are financed in large part not by local lending institutions, but offshore institutions. How do we help local landowners? How do we help local contractors? How do we help local folks who finance and build a product that's designed and built for local folks? And to keep the cost down around $225 per square foot. That is the magic number to incentivize true affordable rentals.
To encourage that kind of low-cost development, the mayor wants to use a combination of tax incentives and streamlined building standards.
Number one, it's only for lots that are 20,000 square feet or under. It provides great benefits in terms of minimum setbacks. You know, we have large setbacks. They're a lot less now. 10 feet for the front yard of a building, 5 feet for the side and rear, which allows more development, usable space to build more affordable rentals. The maximum building area is 80%, which allows more use of the lot. The height is 60 feet. The floor area ratio, which is about density, is 4, which is much higher than it is today. So it provides incentives where you can build more product on your land, get more rental income, and provide more rental housing. You don't have to worry about height setbacks, off-street parking, bicycle parking. It can be on-site. We're allowing parking in the side of the building and in the back. So we're allowing encroachment in that area for parking. But we're trying to address the cost factor. There's not going to be required elevators in this thing. It's going to be walk up one stairwell. All of these go into the cost of trying to keep it in the $225 square foot range. But we're also providing a 10-year real property tax exemption.
Honolulu City Council member Kimberly Pine also supports the bill. She says that development costs are too high for taxpayers to fund alone.
So we need partners in the private sector. And so without taxpayer costs, by giving more density and less setbacks to private developers who want to build these type of units, we'll be getting more affordable housing into the market a lot faster while also benefiting the economy here. We really cannot do this alone on Oahu. We really need every part of government as well as the private sector to be a part of solving the affordable housing crisis. The City Council was unanimously in support of this legislation when it went through the council, and so we'll have very robust discussions, but we will fast track this particular bill to ensure that we get affordable housing in the market a lot faster.
The proposal also has the support of developers like Derek Locke. He praised Caldwell and Pine for working with the private sector in crafting the program.
This was just a great collaboration with the mayor, DPP, City Council, and the private sector to create a bill that would benefit the small landowners. If you drive around the neighborhoods of Makiki and Mo'ili'ili, there's a lot of underutilized lots there with single-family homes, and the landowners are stuck. They can't rebuild through the current zoning code, through the current LUO, through the current building code. And this bill will give them the opportunity to do that. And it's a great opportunity for these people, and it's a great opportunity for renters who want to live in town or other apartment-zoned neighborhoods within the island.
Affordable housing developer Marshall Hung says the proposal will provide a great opportunity for landowners to reduce the cost of redeveloping.
The studies have shown that there are 3,000 apartment zone lots available that need to be taken down and rebuilt. There's a total of 6,000 of these lots. Half of them are probably available to take this opportunity, this five-year window.
Residents also have a big reason to support the bill, according to Honolulu Planning and Permitting Director Kathy Sokugawa.
Previous conversations about what is affordable, people balk at 15 years of affordability or even 30 years of affordability. This project will have 80% of its units affordable for the life of the building. That is a big gift. That is a big incentive for the community in terms of a stable housing supply.
The bill must first be reviewed by the Independent Honolulu Planning Commission before it can go before the City Council for a vote. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
That was the latest plan pitched by the city to offer developers incentives to build mid-rise rental buildings in areas zoned for apartments. It's part of a strategy to deal with the monster home trend that is some taking advantage of weak laws and poor enforcement to put up apartments in areas traditionally zoned for single-family homes. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. There are hundreds of cemeteries throughout the islands, but today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of a 3.5-acre parcel in Honolulu that is not subject to the laws of the U.S. or Hawaii State and is one of two places in Hawaii where the Hawaiian flag is permitted to fly unaccompanied by the stars and stripes of the United States flag. Now, this piece of old Hawaii is managed by the State Parks Division and sits quietly on a less-traveled portion of Nu'uanu Avenue. It's a focal point for Hawaiian organizations and celebrations concerned with the kingdom and the monarchy. Do you know the name of the sacred land? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Sasha Cook from Hawaii Opera Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
During President Donald Trump's State of the Union speech, lots of attention was given to the border wall and the threat of another government shutdown. But others were watching what he said about health care.
It's unacceptable that Americans pay vastly more than people in other countries for the exact same drugs, often made in the exact same place. This is wrong. This is unfair. And together, we will stop it.
AARP's Barbara Kim Stanton was heartened. Trump mentioned the need to curb the spiraling costs of prescription drugs, but she says we need to do more.
We hear so often about people having to choose between rent, food, drugs, and this is just this is at a crisis point, no question. We see, too, and I think a lot of it is there's some common sense solutions that, quite honestly, the big drug companies are just unwilling to do. And I think when you have profits being the message of the day or the goal over trying to get affordable prescription drugs to people, government has to come in. Government has to do things. They can do things like have Medicare negotiate lower drug prices and reduce barriers to global price competition, you know, by doing things like having the safe importation of lower priced drugs, for instance. And you can ask for greater transparency. You could look at the root problem of the prices set by the pharmaceutical companies. And so if you have somebody like HHS negotiate lower drug prices on behalf of Medicare, for instance, you have the safe importation of lower priced drugs. You look at demanding greater transparency of prescription drug pricing. And you also have more research showing what's effective and what's not, so you don't get steered to the higher priced drugs. I think then we have a fighting chance of making drugs more affordable where seniors don't have to make hard choices.
What are you hearing from your members?
Well, we're hearing that really, really expensive. We hear that people are making heart-wrenching choices. We hear sometimes that people have had to move out of their homes because they can't afford their insulin, or that they get depressed, they're despondent because they feel like their own families are sacrificing a lot just to enable them to have the drugs they need. And so this is difficult for them. We hear about seniors actually doing a lot of pill splitting.
Pill splitting?
Yeah.
Explain that.
But, you know, where they have here's the amount of drugs you should be taking, and instead of taking the adequate dosage, you take half of it or you take a fourth of it. And so it isn't as effective as it should be. That's what we call about pill splitting, where they don't take the full dosage. Or if they have to take insulin every day, they take it every third day. This is not helping their health. And yet we can understand why, because, you know, when we look at our research shows that in 2015, the average annual cost of therapy for just one prescription drug used on a chronic basis was almost $13,000 for older adults. And this is equivalent to 80% of the average Social Security retirement benefits, which is about $16,101. And it is more than 50% of the Medicare beneficiaries' median annual income of $25,150. So you can see that $13,000 of a drug that you need to take on a daily basis or a chronic basis totally changes the quality of your life. 80% of Social Security and 50% of the median income of Medicare. That is significant. So you can see the seniors are between a rock and a hard place. But here is what is absolutely shameful about the drug companies. The inflation rate from 2015 of more than 750 prescription drugs commonly used by older adults rose 50 times more than the general inflation rate of 0.1%. So it's drugs that are just skyrocketing, 50 times more than the general inflation rate of 0.1%. Drugs rose 6.4%. And they keep rising. And so something that keeps you alive, that keeps you healthy, should not be something that is used to be used to make a huge profit. You should not be compromising seniors' health. But we really do think that there's common sense solutions, and it just has not been done. So it's now time for government to step in and force the drug companies to have more affordable drug prices.
And are we talking specific diseases, you know, whether it's diabetes or cancer?
Exactly. Diabetes, heart, cancer. Yes, those are the ones. Those are the ones that are bankrupting a lot of seniors.
I did talk with the American Diabetes Association director, and he shared that he was hearing stories about people who were having to move away to Vegas because of the cost of drugs, and they just couldn't afford it here anymore.
That's absolutely correct. You know, when you hear something of, it will cost us $2,000 a day here to get that daily dosage, they have to cut the cost somewhere. So either they have to go to some place like Las Vegas, or they have to go to another state where they have better drug coverage costs, or else they have lower cost of living costs. But the seniors are making very tough choices, and they should be living the lives they want. And many of them just want to stay in Hawaii, but they're being forced out because of the high cost of drugs.
Now, I understand that there's some legislation this session that is looking at trying to make it more transparent, even locally. I don't know where those measures are. I think one of them had a hearing last week. But are you aware of any of those bills specifically?
Well, we have not talked to the legislators specifically on the bills, but transparency would be a big part of reducing drug pricing. So, yes, that's an important thing to follow.
And what about just Hawaii's population in general and where we sit compared with folks on the mainland?
Well, it's more acute for us just because of the cost of living, but also we have a higher percentage of seniors in our general population. I mean, we're talking about one out of every five persons in the state of Hawaii being over the age of 62, and by 2030, it's going to be one out of every four. And so just by percentage and the fact that we have the highest longevity of any state, you can see that this is a greater problem for Hawaii residents who are over the age of 62. So this problem is not going to go away. We have a greater senior population, and they live the longest. So I think that we absolutely have to head on, take on some solutions, some common sense solutions that will reduce the price of these high drug costs.
We have more to lose.
Oh, we have a lot to lose. This is something that if you're not taking the drug, believe me, and a high-paying drug, you know somebody who is. Probably a family member, a neighbor, a friend. But, yes, it affects everybody. You know, AARP was listening to the State of the Union address, and we will be having to work with the appropriate departments to make sure that there's more attention to this because it's a crisis, a growing crisis of skyrocketing prescription drug costs, prices that really cannot be ignored. And so we wish the president had said more. But we'll just have to keep working with the president and the congressional leaders because we are going to need a solution the sooner the better to lower drug prices. We have to see what happens to the Medicare cost because, like I said, it's 50% right now of the Medicare beneficiaries' medium income.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to point out something else. You know, for the seniors on Medicare, we're talking about the chronic drugs. On average, seniors take 4.5 medications a month. And so you can see that as you get older, you're really talking about a lot of medication. Now, if it turns out you're taking medications for chronic conditions, then you really are doubling the cost of prescription drugs.
That was Barbara Kim Stanton, director of AARP here in Hawaii, talking about the president's State of the Union address. In the headlines, huge fines for a former trustee of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. That's the focus of our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Politics and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us this morning. Hi.
Hi, Catherine. Good morning.
So, Rowena Akana, a bunch of money she's got to pay up, huh?
Yeah, she sure does. $23,000 and some change. This is from the State Ethics Commission. They say that Rowena Akana violated the ethics code 47 times. Akana's lawyer, Jim Bickerton, says that she will be appealing this. She does have to get that fine paid in 2 months. But boy, not only that, there's another $21,000 that she may also be on the hook for. She may have to pay back that amount in gifts that she received. The case, by the way, has been referred by the Ethics Commission to the State Attorney General's office.
Oh, interesting. Now, I know Rowena has been a long time OHA trustee, like 3 decades.
Right. And of course, she lost re-election this past year. And one of the complaints that she and her attorney Bickerton have made was the timing of the Ethics Commission hearing. That was just a few weeks before the general election. Dan Gluck, the Ethics Commission director, says, no, that was something that was agreed to by both parties. But certainly there were bad headlines. Well, headlines anyway that didn't reflect well on the trustee as she was in this tight race. Remember how it is with a runoff with OHA. It's the top three candidates that go on and win the positions. And she lost. And yeah, after 3 decades, that's a big shock.
Right. And I think probably there's some thought that she should have known better.
Well, I think that would exactly be the case, although there is some disagreement about this. Bickerton says, by the way, that $21,000, she was using that money to file a lawsuit, which, by the way, was against her fellow trustees at OHA. But Bickerton argued that this was in her official capacity. And I should also point out that Bickerton has said that a number of those expenditures for which the Ethics Commission has flagged her on were actually approved by OHA. But here's what the Ethics Commission says. No, that kind of rings hollow. In particular, they called attention to evidence that they say O'Connor, and I'm using the words of Anita Hofschneider's story today, bullied, intimidated, and threatened OHA staff who were actually reviewing those very same expenditures. So, yes, in some cases she may have should have known better. In other cases, she's saying that she followed OHA procedure.
And I know, I think part of the argument was that maybe perhaps the OHA trustees aren't bound by the ethics law.
Well, they certainly are. They are state employees, even though OHA is a quasi-governmental agency. They are elected, the trustees, by the voters. They do have to abide by the ethics code. There is some argument that if you're using money to benefit Hawaiians, and of course that's what OHA does, and it gets primarily most of its money or a good chunk of it from ceded land revenue, that they have some discretion in terms of how that's spent. But you know, one thing she did is she bought an airline Premier Club membership. Now, you can't do that. She overcharged for internet service. You can't do that. So these were definite no-nos that the Ethics Commission raised.
I know I was Googling last night all the other states that have ethics laws and who's covered by it. And I was actually surprised there are some states that don't have ethics laws. I think Idaho was one of them. I was like, wow, that was a head scratcher.
Yeah, we actually have a pretty, all in all, a pretty good ethics code. There are some exceptions here and there, but that is the job of the State Ethics Commission. And by the way, they provide training on this whenever somebody gets into office or a position in government. They are apprised of this. There are different rules that apply to different levels of government, but this is part of our governing document. It's the State Ethics Code.
Right, and I know the chunk of money that she got for that lawsuit that she filed, that was funded by Princess Kavana Nakoa because of questions about what was happening within the office and what they were doing.
Right, and this is one of Akana's arguments, is that she has challenged the development interests that OHA has in Kaka'aka, where they own lands. But what the Ethics Commission said was, look, you told us about this late. You should have filed this. You should have disclosed this fully. There are things that you have to follow by law in order to do your job.
Yeah. Well, never a dull moment at OHA. Thanks. Thanks, Chad.
Okay, Catherine.
That was Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story on the ethics flap, visit civilbeat.org.
Oscar Arias, the Nobel Prize winner and former president of Costa Rica, is accused of sexually assaulting 4 women. One of them is a former journalist. She recalls Arias groping her in a crowded room.
And then saying something like, oh, you're not wearing a bra, and then walking off.
Why Emma Daly is telling her story now. She's on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Big Island designer Iris Gill Viracrucis recreated a collection of royal gowns in a nod to our Hawaii monarchs. His experience studying fashion design and theatrical costuming in California and Paris came together in a project with Iolani Palace. We caught up with him at a special night tour of the historic home, where his creations added just the right royal touch.
Oh,
Sweet and Lovely is just how Hawaiian singer Raiatea Helm looked in a replica of one of Princess Kaʻiulani's gowns. Iʻolani Palace chose the Big Island's creative spirit, Iris Gill, to recreate the gowns worn by Hawaii's monarchy. Five of them, to be exact, which added just the right touch to showcase the palace rooms.
The ribbon gown is actually one of my favorite ones to talk about based on the fact that it actually is started, if I were to show you the history behind it, because it was restyled several times. So they were even, you know, sort of like frugal chic. So they actually redesigned and repurposed the gown and things like that. And that was the last of the recreation, the reincarnation of that gown.
On a recent night tour of Iʻolani Palace marking Queen Kapiʻolani's birthday, the gowns were on display, much to the delight of those who wanted to experience the monarchy period in our island's history.
The queen is wearing her famed peacock dress, and you'll see that downstairs in the throne room, a facsimile of that. It's noted that she is sitting down because that dress
On this particular evening, as Raiatea Helm sang in the Great Hall, she slipped into two different gowns. The blue number was a showstopper, with a long, elegant train fit for a princess.
It's actually made out of a crushed velvet, and it's lined with a synthetic moire. There is a bodice, which is a top, with laces and beads, and it's encrusted with appliques. And as you can see, the inside has like bonings that actually normally would have had like whale bonings and things like that. So by itself, it's actually sort of like corseted. This is the back of the skirt, and this is the front.
Wow, fancy!
Well, they were for royalty, so this is sort of like not in the Kalakaua sets. So this is actually more of a Queen Emma. So where this actually gets pulled up, and there'll be like bustles that actually will sit behind her.
So tell us then, you were able to fit Raiatea in this gown.
Yes.
That is one of her changes. This is
yes.
Gown number two for the evening.
Yes. She actually flew in, you know, I took her measurement. I showed her, you know, the dynamics of how it's going to be done. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of the gowns are actually separate pieces. So, and even to this particular recreation that I'm doing for her, as a costume actually has a lot of that particular details on it. So down to like the accessories, she's actually going to have a bird of paradise. This is actually about 100 years old.
Wow.
And this is going to go on her hair. So, you know, down to the jewelries, I actually have, like, some of the royal orders embroidered in Pakistan. So it's a little bit more lighter as opposed to the metal ones. So the ones that you see displayed and things like that are the replica of the royal orders, except for their embroideries as opposed to metal. So then they don't wear the gowns down.
How did you get to be, I guess, the royal gown maker?
Desiree Cruz is actually one of my dearest friend, because I actually started with the Mary Monarch. I live in Hilo. So I was asked by the YWCA. I have a few friends that was actually asked me to actually produce a fashion show. And at that time, Uncle George Niobe was still alive. And I did a gown, which is similar to what this one is, however, it was in red. Desiree actually will wear that. And after a while, I got introduced to Mary Monarch, and then when Desiree Cruz was actually invited to sing the Queen's song on one of these evening tours, they actually end up, you know, asking who made that dress, and that's how, and because the thing is like, it has the hook and eye and everything else and stuff like that, so they knew that it was something a little different than most people have done before. Okay. The curator at that time said that we would like to actually talk to him and see if this is something that could be done for the palace, to give it a little bit more personal touch. As you can see when you walk in, there's the personality of the queen in the room. So not just lifeless items and the spirit of the ali'is. And even looking at Raiatea singing and that, a lot of people just like, oh my gosh, that's her. So it adds a very nice aura, and a lot of people have seen it and things like that. Yeah, it's like, you know, it felt like the queen was present.
It's a wonderful touch.
Thank you. Hoping, you know, they are going to continue with the project and things like that. So supposedly we actually was supposed to do the king, of course, because this is his palace, and then there was a princess and so on and so forth. But, you know, they're actually restructuring things now and things and stuff like that. So there will be project that would continue on this particular thing because a lot of people took very much, you know, great interest in regards to the addition to the palace. Just fabulous. Like how they actually recreated the furnishings, like the carpets and things like that. And that's coinciding with the whole package in regards to getting the feel on how the Ali'i lived back then.
So wonderful touch to the evening. Wonderful
thank you.
Touch.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else you want to add just about, you know, why you love recreating this period?
Well, like I said, you know, a lot of times, and I tell people, because when we were dressing up the royal court and Mary Monarch, I said, you're not dressing up as some fictional character. They're actually, you know, once living and alive, you know, great couple. And if it wasn't for them, there was none of these. And that alone right there is worth remembering them by. And they actually took so much pride in regards to representing Hawaii to the world. That's why a lot of people are like, oh, they've squandled money and things like that. No, they actually had to represent that. I mean, if you look at, you know, Queen Victoria's Jubilee, if you look at the picture and things like that were on the painting, they weren't guests somewhere else. They were right there in the altar where they belong with the Ali'i and things like that. And that's something that a lot of people need to take pride on and on how they actually, you know, projected that on how Hawaii was recognized. So it was the only Ali'i in the Pacific that was ever recognized.
And it's wonderful because of the exhibit at the Honolulu Museum. It really just brings it all together.
Yes, no, exactly. And, you know, in that alone right there, if you look at his jacket, the embroideries on it and things and stuff like that, it has, like, the kalo, it has the ferns. So he actually even took a lot of initiative in regards to researching it while he was traveling on how different countries, because if you look at the crown, if you look at the royal orders and things like that, you'll see little kahilis. So a lot of those things, which is part of, you know, what Hawaii represented and things like that, was actually in these dresses.
Very symbolic.
Just like with the featherworks and everything else, stuff like that. It's like the most highest art craft that is linked to the Ali'i. And here it is in dresses and things like that. So even that alone right there, they're forward thinking in regards to they couldn't dress up in traditional, you know, tapa and so on and so forth. So what are they brought over? Like the story that I'm telling people in regards to the Leihulu, they actually took an old cape that was falling apart and then made those Leihulu in front of the gown. That's why if you look at it, it looks a little tattered and things stuff like that.
But repurposed.
So, exactly. So, and that's basically what the whole thing in regards to bringing their magic back.
It must be just so special knowing you have this part in kind of recreating this history for everybody to appreciate.
That's what, and I'm very blessed, and I'm very thankful and very honored.
That was Hilo designer Iris Gill. Next week, we talk with designer Kenny Zamora of Project Runway fame. He's been working on a replica of the Queen's coronation gown and more.
Aloha, I'm Kelly Markgraf from Hawaii Opera Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we asked you to name a 3.5-acre parcel of land in Honolulu that's one of two places in Hawaii where the Hawaiian flag is permitted to fly unaccompanied by the U.S. flag. The sacred land in Nu'uanu is called Mauna Ala, the royal mausoleum. It's the final resting place for all Iwi Ali'i, all the royal bones, from the Kamehameha dynasty and the Kalakaua dynasty, with the exception of King Lunalilo. He is buried at Kauai Hau Church with his father, Kanaina. Now, the history books say Lunalilo wanted to be with the common people rather than with Ali'i. If you are wondering the location of the other Hawaiian flag that is permitted to fly solo, it is at Iolani Palace. Thanks to listener Sally Hill for this backyard quiz. And congratulations, our winner today is Noel Kahanu from Maiea. You got it right. That's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're digging in today in what's been described as an exceptional garden. It was an inspiration for the founding of the nation's Garden Conservatory. It was the first private garden funded by the effort which transformed it from a private garden to a public treasure. The garden isn't here in the islands, but rather in Walnut Creek, California. But its director, Brian Kemble, has his roots in Hawaii. Kemble has been with the Ruth Bancroft Gardens for close to 40 years. We caught up with him at a backyard gathering with members of Hawaii's Cactus and Succulent Society. Kemble talked to us about his bold and dry garden and growing up in one of Oahu's wettest neighborhoods.
Well, it's quite a transition because I grew up in Manawili, which is on the wet side of Oahu, and very high rainfall every year. And we get much less in California, about 20 inches in the Bay Area. And so that's considerably less rainfall. But however, a lot of succulents come from places where the rainfall is in the summertime and is dry in the winter. And that's the opposite of us. We have a Mediterranean climate in California, so our rainfall is all in the wintertime and completely dry in the summer. People oftentimes come to the Bancroft Garden and they say, well, you probably don't have to water, do you? Because these are all desert plants that are adapted to dry conditions. And we say, oh, we certainly do have to water because a lot of the plants in the garden, like most of the cacti, for example, come from places that get rainfall in the summertime. And if we didn't water them in the summertime, they wouldn't grow. So they do have to get watered. And the real question for us is, will they tolerate our rainfall in the wintertime when they really don't want it? And some will and some won't. And by trial and error, we discover which ones.
So share with our listeners what the Ruth Bancroft Gardens is all about.
Well, Ruth lived in Walnut Creek, and she was an avid gardener. She had a rose garden and an iris garden and an herb garden and so forth. And she began to get interested in succulents. In the 60s and the 70s, she really started collecting succulents. And she had a little garden where she grew them in the ground, but a very small one. And in 1971, her husband took out 3.5 acres of walnut trees. And so that left a large space for her to work with. And so she set to work planting a big garden out in the ground and hired a landscaper to help her lay it out. And he recommended a pool in the middle because he thought that there was a nice play between the dry landscape and the water of the pool. And so she dug a pool and put that in the middle. And he gave her some trees and things because he said, over time, you're going to want areas of dappled light, areas of shade, areas of sun, and the trees will give you the varying kinds of sunlight conditions that you need for varying plants. So he got her started, and then she took it from there. And it's really amazing to see what she did, because at that time in the 70s, it was considered sort of heresy to plant succulents. You know, people, what are you doing? You know, you're supposed to plant a lawn and grow all these conventional things like roses that everybody else grows. And Ruth had her own ideas, and she went about planting all these succulents. And actually, cacti were not for her a focus in the beginning. She was more interested in rosette succulents, like the aloes and the agaves and the echeverias. And over time, she got more and more interested in the cacti, and they became an important part of the mix as time went along.
Now, California has had its challenges with water, too.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. So when Ruth planted the garden in the early 70s, there were no restrictions on water, but in the late 70s we had a drought, and we've had other droughts since, and on some occasions the water supply has been so low that they've had to have restrictions on water usage, and so everybody's become much more aware of water usage and plants that don't require so much water to keep up. So a lot of water districts now have a program where if you take out your lawn and put in something that's drought tolerant, they'll help to subsidize that. So everybody's very into succulents now. They've become a very important thing in the landscape trade. And so Ruth was kind of a pioneer because she was experimenting with these things at a time when other people weren't and when it was still new. And so she experimented with a lot of plants that people didn't know if they would grow in Northern California. And so where she succeeded, then that's been like a pioneering effort for other people to follow. So her garden's become very influential.
Now, the last time I was there, you had a fabulous, I think, art show. You had lots of wonderful art sculptures throughout the garden.
Yes, well, every year the garden hosts a sculpture show in the summertime. And so it's a month when we have all these sculptures set out in the garden, and people who don't even care about the plants come and look at all the sculptures. I always say the plants themselves are sculptures. You know, if you look at an agave and how beautifully sculptural it is, we have sculptures all year round, but we have ones made by people that happen every summer.
It's kind of like bling in the garden, I guess.
Absolutely.
So what is it about succulents that grabs you?
Well, I like their form and their colors. So the rosette form is what first drew me to them. Things like echeverias, the hens and chicks that have that almost like a flower-like form to the plant. And then the colors. The colors that they take on, all these plants that are blue and that are orange and that are pink and that are red, I mean, it's just amazing. You don't need to wait for the flowers to get the color because the plant itself has all this color in it. And to me, that's wonderful. And the more you get into them, the more amazing things you start to see, you know, in the way that they grow and the patterns on their leaves and the colors that they take on and so forth.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, aloes are an early favorite of mine. I was started out with aloes as the first thing I collected. And I was also a co-founder of the Institute for Aloe Studies, which is located in Oakland, California. And so I've been on a lot of trips to Africa and recently to Ethiopia to see, also Madagascar, to see aloes in habitat. And I never get tired of that. I could spend the rest of my life going to see aloes in habitat and never get tired of it.
Do you miss the ginger in wet Mauna Willi?
Absolutely. I love ginger and I love Mauna Willi and I love wet places too. But in terms of the plant life, I'm really drawn to the dry places. And so I do, on many occasions, go to see plants in the desert. Often in Mexico, because Mexico's nearer by. It's not so expensive to fly to as Africa is. But Africa, too, and Madagascar and Namibia and Ethiopia and places where succulents grow.
So where were you most recently?
Most recently in Baja California.
And tonight you're going to be talking with the members of the society about what exactly?
About agaves or century plants. So a lot of people have an idea of a century plant as a giant thing with bluish leaves that send up a stalk like a telephone pole when it blooms. And that's agave americana. That's a very commonly grown agave. But there are other agaves small enough to cup in the palm of your hand. So there are really a great variety in the genus agave, and most of them come from Mexico. We have some in the United States as well, some in the Caribbean, some down to northern South America, but Mexico has the most and the most variety. So I always love to go to Mexico to seek out ones in remote places and have adventures along the way.
And so here in this garden, in this backyard garden, there's some giant stuff that I don't know what they're called. Some of them are pokey, some look hairy.
Yes, well, those are cacti, and there are an awful lot of tall columnar cacti. Everybody knows the saguaro because it's so famous and such an iconic plant, and that's one kind of a columnar cactus, but it doesn't really do very well here, nor does it do well in Northern California either. But there are a lot of other kinds of columnar cacti that have that towering cylindrical stem, and they do really well in Hawaii. In fact, Coco Crater Botanic Garden has many of them, and that's really right near here where we are now, and so the same ones do well here. So Carl has planted them out in his yard, and they've gotten enormous.
And is there any advice you can give fans of cactus and succulents on the neighbor islands, you know, because you've got such different topography and different types of habitat, really, you know? I mean, we're talking volcano to Haleakala.
Yes, well, I think drainage is the most important thing of all, having good drainage. the wetter you are in your location, you could be in Hawaii where you're getting more than 100 inches of rain, and then it's tough to grow cacti because it's just more water than they want, even with really good drainage. But even with a fairly high amount of rainfall, if you have really good drainage, then that's where you've got a leg up on everybody else, because they don't want their feet to be standing there in mucky soil. And if the water just drains away, then they can really tolerate quite a bit of water.
And then what about for eating? Anything that's good to eat around here?
Absolutely. A lot of cacti have edible fruits, like the prickly pears. And those are widely eaten in places where they grow. But the plants themselves, there are some kinds of prickly pear where the new pads, when they first come out, they're tender, and they can be cut up and eaten sort of like string beans and put into stir fries and so forth and so on. And so those are eaten too. People are very good at finding things to live on wherever they come from. And in the Americas, where the cacti come from, they're much used all over the place, not just for eating, but for all sorts of things, for fiber, and for sometimes the core of the cactus is used as a building member and all sorts of things. So people are just good at using things.
Okay, but no cactus or succulent poke on the menu tonight?
No, not on the menu tonight.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, you're welcome.
That was Brian Kemble, director of the Bold and Dry Ruth Bancroft Gardens in the Bay Area, who happened to return home over the holidays visiting family and friends.
The categories of left and right divide our world.
Exit left.
All the left-handed people.
Left-wing extremism.
A right-wing group.
Far right.
Exit right.
These categories also apply to our brains. How the right and left hemispheres shape our view of the world, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, we sit down with Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, so it's your chance to talk to him directly or call our talkback line with your question or concern. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.